Nuestra también, pues al igual que ustedes, mantenemos la certeza de que la tierra es nuestra madre y el agua que corre por sus venas no se vende, pues de ella depende la vida, que es un derecho, añadieron. Por decreto presidencial emitido en 1940, la tribu tiene derechos de disposición de agua de la presa La Angostura para fines de riego de sus propias tierras. En este sentido, en mayo pasado, la Suprema Corte de Justicia de la Nación admitió que la Secretaría del Medio Ambiente no consultó adecuadamente a los yaquis antes de otorgar la autorización para la obra del acueducto y que este proyecto puede afectarlos. No obstante, la Corte no ordenó la suspensión de los trabajos, por eso los yaquis se mantienen en lucha. El Ejército Zapatista y el Congreso Nacional Indígena exigieron la cancelación inmediata de las órdenes de aprehensión y un alto a la fabricación de delitos en contra de integrantes de la tribu, además de que condenaron la criminalización de esta lucha. Si nos tocan a unos, nos tocan a todos, por lo que responderemos en consecuencia ante cualquier intento de reprimir esta digna lucha, advirtieron. Llamaron a la comunidad internacional a solidarizar con la defensa yaqui, a sumarse a sus exigencias y a permanecer atenta a los acontecimientos que se presenten en el territorio de la tribu. Reportó en el noroeste mexicano Adriana Manjarres desde Libera Radio.
En Perú, residentes de la región de Cajamarca conmemoran el primer aniversario de la represión que hicieron policías y soldados contra los residentes locales que defendían los recursos comunitarios. El reporte con Virgilio Carranza.
Con masiva concurrencia de personas recordaron un año de ataque militar y policial al pueblo de Bambamarca. El 4 de julio, como hace un año, el sol brillaba en todo su esplendor, pero esta vez para calentar a los miles de mujeres y hombres que llegaron a las calles y plaza de armas para gritar a todo pulmón, ¡Conga no va! La mañana del 4 de julio del 2012, en Selendín, hombres y mujeres lloraban por la muerte de tres hermanos, dentro de ellos uno muy jovencito, miembros del ejército y la policía, enviados por Yanacocha, habían disparado contra la gente que defendía las lagunas de Conga.
El ejército, la policía, jóvenes, cantidad de gente y los hermanos están en la lucha.
Parecía que nada iba a suceder porque la noche del 3 de julio el presidente del Perú, Ollanta Humala, declaró en estado de emergencia en cuatro provincias de la región Cajamarca. Una de ellas era Hualga y Ubambamarca. Eran las 10 de la mañana, los militares y policías se habían adueñado de la plaza de armas. Impedían que la gente ingresase a su plaza. Eso al parecer indignó a muchos de ellos, especialmente a los jóvenes. En un momento aparecieron por una de las esquinas de la plaza de armas con agua y cohetecillos de fiesta para advertirle a los militares que estaban cometiendo un abuso. Allí inició todo. Con balas de arma de largo alcance destrozaban paredes y ventanas de las casas de la ciudad. La gente usaba agua y piedras para defenderse, pero cerca de las 6 de la tarde ya se hablaba de heridos.
El gerente de la red de salud nos confirmó, como decíamos, que nueve son los heridos. Uno ha sido trasladado hacia Chota y el otro hacia la ciudad de Cajamarca, y este sería el tercero, que sería trasladado, mejor dicho, pues transferido a otro nosocomio, en este caso a la ciudad de Cajamarca.
Joselito Vázquez Jambo había fallecido.
Es confirmado el primer fallecido, Joselito Vázquez Jambo, precisos instantes en que le estaban preparando la ambulancia, como decía, unos instantes, ya falleció. Hablamos entonces de Joselito Vázquez Jambo, de 28 años de edad. La razón sería un impacto de bala en la altura del pecho, la que lo habría dejado sin vida.
Luego de un año, la población se reúne no para festejar, sino para mostrar su cólera, su rabia, su indignación, su impotencia, porque no hay justicia. Nadie del gobierno ha seguido el caso, salvo algunas instituciones que defienden los derechos humanos. La abogada Zulma Villa Sánchez menciona que el gobierno de Ollanta ni siquiera ha respondido a los pedidos de la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos.
Con relación al caso del megaproyecto Conga, como ustedes saben, este caso se encuentra en la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. Lo que se ha hecho ante la comisión es presentar una medida cautelar, que son estas acciones urgentes, y también una petición, que es una denuncia. Con esos dos mecanismos, las rondas campesinas han acudido ante el sistema interamericano para decir que el megaproyecto Conga es inviable, ¿no?, y se paralice. Ahorita estamos en una fase más bien de pedido de información por parte de la Comisión Interamericana al Estado peruano. La comisión, en el mes de abril, después de haber realizado ya durante 2012 de tres reuniones de trabajo, ha pedido información sobre cuál es la situación de los líderes y lideresas que están siendo amenazados y amenazadas.
Para Para los elendinos y bambamanquinos, la resistencia no ha terminado. Están decididos a seguir hasta las últimas consecuencias. El gobierno peruano permitirá que Yanacocha siga matando más hombres y mujeres que se oponen a sus ambiciones de mineral. Virgilio Carranza, Radio Coremarca, Bambamanca.
El campesinado de Colombia en la región del Catatumbo discute un acuerdo preliminar con el gobierno para levantar su protesta que lleva casi un mes. Los agricultores piden se declare zona de reserva campesina al Catatumbo para que la empobrecida comunidad decida el futuro de la rica zona mineral y energética. Vladimir Carrillo con la información.
Mientras participa en la preparación del almuerzo para 350 personas que acompañan a la delegación campesina en la mesa de diálogos, José del Carmen ve en la olla comunitaria el mejor ejercicio democrático. Aquí todos ponen y todos comen.
Uno quiere que los hijos sufran lo mismo que uno está sufriendo, y que el pueblo no sufra, los niños que están naciendo y que vienen de nacer, que no sufran la necesidad que nosotros estamos sufriendo. Entonces queremos un mañana mejor para que vivan bien.
Ejercicio democrático que Carlos Julio, vocero de los campesinos en la mesa de diálogo, no ve en la delegación del gobierno, que desde el Ministerio de Defensa ha rechazado la declaratoria de la zona de reserva campesina.
Y la traición del Ministerio de Defensa. Yo me atrevo a decirlo, no me importa si mañana, lo he dicho, si me muero o me desaparecen, es el Estado colombiano y totalmente el Ministerio de Defensa, porque yo sí lo digo así, porque estoy reclamando tierra para mis hijos y para los que no son mis hijos.
No declarar la zona de reserva campesina significa para los líderes juveniles que participan en la protesta el no futuro para ellos, que históricamente han soportado la falta de centros de salud, de electrificación, de agua potable, de vías de comunicación, de alimentación suficiente y adecuada y de oportunidades laborales.
Compañeros que se les mataron el papá, desaparición, bueno, muchas cosas hemos vivido. Por eso los jóvenes del Catatumbo estamos presentes, estamos conscientes de que estamos en un abandono completamente del Estado.
La precaria inversión social para la iglesia de Tibú, que acompaña los diálogos, debe tener una salida desde la concertación y con la voluntad del gobierno colombiano necesarias para construir una... de la fuerza pública, lo que habría provocado la muerte de los cuatro campesinos.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
And coming up next, we have Free Radio's most impressive show on the air, Bathrob Spears, Broadsides, with special guest Dennis Ettler. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're here, of course, to trim my sails and to provide for a kind of educational dialogue on the Egyptian scene.
Yeah. We've had a little bit of ongoing discussion, you know, on the internets. So
we're also going to have, I'm going to play some tape, of course, from folks on the street, a lot of interviews at the Red Church, updates on the latest city council meeting, city council to those who are more reverential towards our legislative body, and your calls. Call-in number here is 831-427-3772. Again, 427-3772. Call in, join the discussion, ask questions, demand answers, interrupt, praise the talkers, whatever you want to do. Again, the number is 427-3772. And we'll begin with a little musical interlude so I can kind of get my grounding here. Here's some Peggy Seeger from her album Live.
There was an advert, I was in a Santa Monica paper, it said, penis enlargement, big letters. And in little letters it said, for men only. The man waited, the woman groaned. She was lost in labor's toil, forgotten for now the long 9 months, the act of passion and joy.
arms, 2 eyes, 2 ears, a mouth and a nose, and that 1 inch of flesh that proclaims it's a boy. The midwife inspected his belly and bum, counted appendages one by one, took his sweet willy twixt finger and thumb, looked at it in wonder and said, does this little spike of flesh define the stronger sex? Will this little pleasure rod put this baby next to God? Is this the thing that gets him higher wages? That's kept him up on top throughout the ages? Will these round thingamabobs get this child a better job? Pilot, not a stewardess. Doctor, not a nurse. Professor, not a teacher. A chance to get there first. The scepter that makes kingdoms. The key that opens doors. The reason why this baby won't be scrubbing kitchen floors. She laid the little dickie down and gave a weary smile. Give him an inch and he'll take a mile.
And that was Peggy. And the name of that particular number was Give Him an Inch. So there. So, you know, maybe we should begin with the famed but very unpublicized discussion that we've kind of been having over the last week with the upsurge of activity in Egypt. I thought we might begin by kind of reading a little modern Egyptian history from the Wikipedia. I brought it up on the screen, as you know, or I said a moment ago. What do you think? Would that be a good idea to begin this discussion?
Well, sure. I mean, I think most people aren't really all that aware of Egyptian history, and as with not only Egypt, but virtually any other place in the world, if you don't know the history, you can't really understand what's going on in the present. So
I'm not sure if they have 64 million or 46 million, but they've got...
In terms of their population?
Right.
Well, it's about more like 80 million.
80 million. I see now. Have you been there counting recently?
Well, I keep up with these things.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely around 80 million, which is, of course, they're all concentrated in the Nile river valley and delta, so it's a very constricted aerial distribution. Most of the country, of course, is the Saharan Desert.
You know, Egypt, and of course, this is it's probably one of the oldest civilizations, not the oldest, but one of the oldest. If you look at the, I mean, according to the Wikipedia.
Yeah, well, being an archaeologist, I have some knowledge of this. And,
you've been digging around in Egypt, stealing their local antiquities?
I did most of my work, all of my work, actually, in China.
That's true. And originally we were going to talk about China, but it all seemed a little, how would the Chinese put it? very good. Nicely. Probably is interesting.
It is interesting, but not in light of what's going on.
There's more kind of, seems to be more happening, at least in the eye of the media, in Egypt. So.
Yeah, for sure. But no, Egypt, Samaria, China. Now, just recently, a new discovery, well, not so new, but just recently publicized some of the earliest possibly written material, symbols, that are antecedent to the Chinese characters have been discovered, that date back around the same time as the Egyptian hieroglyphics and Sumerian cuneiform writings.
We'll be
began.
Delving into that probably a few shows down the line.
Yeah, about 5,000 years ago.
And I'll leave that to the... I find it interesting, but I note the history of Egypt that gives you prehistoric Egypt, which is before 3100 B.C. or B.C.E., as some say. There's an ancient Egypt for the early dynastic period, the Old Kingdom, the First Intermediate Period, the Middle Kingdom. I'm going to skip ahead past all these kingdoms.
Yeah, I think that's advisable. Yeah.
And there's classical antiquity where you had, Ptolemaic Egypt, and, you had Julius Caesar and Cleopatra, all those people.
We don't want to forget
Mark
her.
Anthony and Cleopatra, Shakespeare's folks. And then you had Sassanid Egypt, which was right before the Islamic period.
Well, there's the Christian Coptic period, you know.
Okay, but probably Roman and Byzantine Egypt. I'm missing that one.
Yeah, Byzantine. Whatever.
Then in the Middle Ages, you had Arab Egypt, Fatimid Egypt, Ayyubid Egypt, and Mamluk Egypt. These were different sort of regimes by the Islamic folks.
Yeah, yeah. Modern Egyptian history really begins with the Ottoman conquest.
1517 to 1867, followed by the French occupation.
Yeah, French and British.
And then and then under Muhammad Ali, briefly, I guess, was he British, Muhammad Ali?
No. He was an Egyptian, but, supported by the British, propped him up.
Propped him up.
Yeah.
Sort of like the U.S. is propping up every regime that comes down the road.
We've taken over the mantle of the British Empire.
We being them and Washington, of course.
Well, I'm not referring to you and I.
No, certainly not.
I'm using the... Well,
identifying yourself with the oppressor, eh, Dennis? So, the Kingdom of Egypt was around 1922 to 1953. And then we get to the modern times for the Republic of Egypt. I'm going to start, reading a little bit about that. General Abdul Nasser, Gamal Abdul Nasser, not general, established a military dictatorship. I guess he was a military man, with a one-party state known as the Republic of Egypt following the 1952 Egyptian Revolution. This is going to become, a point you're going to probably be making is that you have some positive views of the military because you feel that Nasser not only ripped the country away from a British overlordship, but also introduced numerous reforms.
Oh, most assuredly. He's still recognized as the founder of modern Egypt and a great national hero.
In spite of his one-party state?
The Egyptian people...
An old Leninist like you has no problems
people,
with a one-party state?
Nobody in their right mind would challenge Nasser. His popularity was so great, really, that it would have been absurd for anybody... I mean, because they had presidential election in whatever it was, 1960 or something, and he ran unopposed because no one...
Well, they said the same thing about every dictator always runs unopposed.
In many cases, it's true because, the whole nation was epitomized by Nasser. I mean, he was the face of the nation, and he was a revered figure. So that happens quite frequently.
He's also famous for being part of the big non-aligned bloc, which kind of stood between the Soviet Union and the U.S. Empire. It was kind of U.S. wasn't quite an empire. It was more a series of protectorates, perhaps, in those days. But Egypt, Indonesia for a while, India, Yugoslavia.
And China. China attended the non-aligned bloc meetings.
Really?
Saw itself as a member of the Third World. They invented the term for Third World.
Those commies, they get everywhere. What can you do? All right. So, in any case, Egypt was ruled autocratically by three presidents over the following six decades, by Nasser from 1954 until his death in 1970, by Anwar Sadat from 1971 until his assassination in 1981, and by the much-beloved Hosni Mubarak, speaking sarcastically, from 1981 until his resignation in the face of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution. After 2012... After more than 1 year under interim government of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, was pretty good at killing people as well, as I understand.
Well, they didn't kill that many, in the grand scheme of things.
Well, that's a good question, and I'd like to get some figures. I don't know if you have them. How many died under the military dictatorship, and even how many were imprisoned and tried by military courts, compared to the following year with the democratically elected regime?
Discuss that in greater detail. You have with democratic...
But let me finish the sentence. You may then interrupt me at will. Mohamed Morsi, who was recently ousted and arrested along with many members of his party, as well as 53 of them shot dead, and hundreds more wounded outside.
Well, they also engaged in paramilitary death squads. I mean,
not at that particular point when they were shot dead 3 days ago.
Well, yeah, but they were out there lynching opponents.
Not at that point 3 days ago when they were shot dead.
Prior to that.
Well, that may well be true, but the fact is, in the meantime, you don't go shooting the protesters in Tahrir Square dead, or anywhere in any square for that matter,
view. What about, do you know what happened back in 1968?
Oh, you mean in Mexico when they murdered all those students?
Right.
You don't go shooting the fucking Mexican students dead. And if somebody tried to justify that, I would be just
Americans
as hostile.
How many know about that?
I think a lot of lefties know about that.
Okay, maybe. But it's not ever mentioned in the media.
Well, you did mention, I think, in Bangkok, there was another...
2010.
In 2010, there was a big massacre, may have read about, but it's not on the top of my mind.
There have been massacres left and right.
Yes, but you're skipping away from the point.
No,
the point,
it's not
the point. When I talk about the murders of people 3 days ago by the military...
Well, it's not a cut and dry.
Largely, it's not never cut and dry. Well, at least in this case, it's not.
No.
Well, sometimes. It is, but no. You know, in this situation, there are some reports that there were some shots fired on both sides, but you got to look at the casualty figures, and it looks pretty much like a massacre.
It was a massacre.
Right.
Who's going to deny a massacre when there's 55?
But you don't start babbling about, about brotherhood lynchings at other times to justify this kind of a massacre.
It's not a matter of justification. It's a matter of putting things in perspective.
Well,
there's a big difference between
I don't think
having a perspective on what's going on and justifying,
We're getting into an early argument here, folks, but let me... maybe we should skip some of this history, because I don't know that it's pretty detailed here, and of course, you're really hearing the meat.
I'm kind of familiar with the general outline, so, if need be, we can refer back to what's discussed.
The most recent concerns that I think, at least I have had, have to do with. I mean, I'm a big fan of
the Muslim Brotherhood.
Of not really. Although I don't know much about the Muslim Brotherhood, except that my awareness of. I know there's a lot of anti-Muslim feeling in this country.
It has nothing to do with anti-Muslim feeling to be because the vast majority of 90% of Egyptians are Muslim.
Right.
And
a majority of the electorate voted for the Muslim Brotherhood.
The majority of the electorate did.
Okay.
Not
well, we have a point of dispute.
No, there's no dispute.
I
know the figures the number of people and the percent of the electorate who voted in that presidential election.
A plurality.
And the percent of the people who voted for Moses.
All right. A plurality of the people voted for the Muslim Brotherhood.
It was about, if you figure it all out, I'll tell you right now, it was something like 43% of the electorate voted in that presidential election because the choice that was presented to them was untenable.
I agree.
It was between... last prime minister under Mubarak.
An old hack.
An old hack. And because the secular opposition was so fragmented and so lacking in leadership...
they had a number of candidates.
They had a number of candidates, but they couldn't unite behind one. So what you got was this guy named Sharif, I think, who was the last prime minister under Mubarak, and people were not going to vote for those who were in the revolutionary upsurge were never going to vote for that guy. And so some of them said, well, let's cross our fingers and vote for Mosni. Even though nearly 60% of the country, in one of the most important decisive elections in Egyptian history, boycotted the election. That just shows you that, it was a deeply flawed election.
They didn't,
60%,
they didn't like the candidate.
60%
was it,
even
was it a deeply flawed election, or was it a deeply flawed opposition who just couldn't get their shit together?
Well, the thing is, the Muslim Brotherhood had been acting as a cohesive formation for 60 years.
Underground, admittedly.
Well, that's, of course, that gave them even greater, cohesion, because they were, functioning as almost a Leninist, type party.
Mm-hmm.
And the opposition, which had been fragmented under Mubarak and oppressed and suppressed.
Mubarak was the previous dictator of Egypt.
Couldn't get their act together. They didn't have any leadership. So then, they were able to, the old guard, was able to present this prime minister as a candidate, and he got enough votes in the runoff, you know, to be there in the final round against Mosny, okay? So you get 60% of the people boycotting the election because of the lack of choice, as they saw it.
Sounds like the United States.
We get about that in the off-year elections, 60% voting for the presidential election. But 51% voted for Mosny. So, 50% of, 42%, that comes down to about 21% of the people actually voted.
Right, I wasn't talking about the people. I was talking about
you
the...
said they had a majority of
electorate.
We can rewind
the tape. True, but I meant, forgive me, let me clarify, those who voted in the election.
Those who voted in the election.
The electorate, except in Australia where you get fined for not voting. I guess some countries are like that. You don't usually get a huge turnout of these elections, perhaps because...
Or in Iraq Saddam Hussein, where you got 99% voting.
And in Nazi Germany, the Führer himself did very well, I understand.
Yeah. But now let's get serious.
But, the reality
is that Mosny had about, because the Muslim Brotherhood has about a third of the electorate.
But what are we arguing
about?
That's
about it. But two-thirds of the people who hate them, who just hate the Muslim Brotherhood. And are totally alienated by their year in office, so you get twice as many people out.
Well, they
in
might
the
again. We don't want to jump ahead. I mean, they before they were in office, they were to some extent certainly a part of the opposition to Mubarak.
But they were not involved in the revolution.
Well, they were not on the streets.
They were
true.
Not on the streets. They basically rode piggyback on it.
Right, similar to what the military did.
Well, the military stepped in to preserve public order. I mean, the country was, there was no, if you have a revolutionary situation, but you don't have any revolutionary leadership, then you have chaos. Because there's nobody to step into the breach.
Oh, I think people could find people to step into the breach.
Well, they tried, but they couldn't because they couldn't come to any consensus.
Well,
so what are you supposed to do? I mean, the army has always been the guarantor of the Egyptian state from Nasser on.
Wait a minute. The army for the last 40 years has been the corrupt institution running lots.
Right, but it's the army that Nasser was established.
You have this fetish with this guy Nasser. You love him so much.
No, I don't love the guy. He was the father of the modern Egyptian nation, and he's widely respected and revered, not only in Egypt, but throughout the Arab world. If you don't understand Nasserism and pan-Arab socialism, which he was the exemplar of, you don't understand
hasn't been much said about pan-Islamic or
pan-Arab.
Pan-Arab, thank you, socialism.
That
hasn't been around for some time, really, as far as I know.
Well, that was a major defeat for the Arab people that the legacy
well,
of
Well, people
Nasser
like
was...
ourselves who are sympathetic towards socialism, for sure. But again, I guess the issue that we have here is, in the last week, Egypt has... seen an uprising of the people and also a seizure of power by the military.
The people wanted the army to step in.
Don't be so quick to be to justify the military.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just telling you what happened.
Well, you sound
it's not a matter of justification. You have the idea you have the idea that if you try to understand what's going on, you're justifying it. I'm just acting as a observer.
No, I'm noticed. You're not an observer. You're a partisan. Come on, no.
10,000 miles.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You are a strong, and passionate advocate. I don't want to hear any bullshit from you here, Dennis. So, and I am just to some extent, for sure. But I think I'm trying, and perhaps you are too, trying to find out, what's really going to happen, and how can people over here best assist.
The Egyptian in any realistic fashion.
Well, in the sense, first, at least understand
their own issues, and,
for sure, but understand what's going on.
Yeah, understand.
So that's hopefully what we're eventually, if we ever stop interrupting. We will never stop interrupting each other, but if we, maybe in the midst of these interruptions, people, you can interrupt us, callers, 427-3772, if you want to call in and add your voice to the cacophony here in the studio. So, One of the big issues, and I know you have a very pat answer to this one.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've heard it before, and I've heard it from other people too, and I even considered it myself on occasion before. I'm still considering it, actually. As I mentioned before, quickly added when I said, you know, this was an uprising and followed by or, you know, simultaneous with a coup by the military. And I saw this, and I think a lot of commentators see this, although that doesn't mean they're right or I'm right, as an exploitation of the situation by the military, where the military essentially used the missteps would be a little weak, but the abuses or the problems or the failures of Masri, the interim elected president.
Morsi,
thank you. Morsi, thanks. To themselves take power and, you know, start shooting down opponents and,
well, you know,
and jailing lots of people.
Yeah,
and we're not talking, again, and I have to, okay. You're interrupting. You are. You don't, you see, you hear that and you're afraid people are going to get a negative view of your pals in the military.
I'm just trying to respond to what you're saying. Well,
right.
You tell me when I can speak.
For sure.
I
appreciate that. And I'll come to the end of the sentence shortly. But, you know, there people who've observed the course of events in the last week, at least I'll just say myself, been seriously concerned about the fact that the military, not just its history, and I don't mean its Nasserite history, I mean its history after Nasser and after Sadat, it has largely been, as far as I know, not the champion of the Egyptian people. But, I mean, the Egyptian people, I think, like to... And they may think with this or they may think that, and I'm not saying that they're wrong in what they're thinking. But I think we have to think independently about what we see going on. You and I have our own opinions, which may or may not be those of the Egyptian people. You can certainly represent them if you want, and although you have to start speaking Arabic, perhaps, and that would be difficult for some of us.
I speak Chinese, but I don't speak
Arabic. Could try speaking Chinese. That would be even worse, probably. But although it probably has a Chinese population, and I don't want to get lost there. So, the basic situation was dictator Mubarak gets thrown out in 2011 by a mass uprising of the people. The military takes control for about a year and a half, engaging in lots of military trials of people who were in the revolution, not the old officials who were, torturing people and false and jailing them and stealing their whatever little they have, but the people that were in the revolution. So the military engaged in a serious amount of repression and abuse. Then they gave up power. In fact, when people started rebelling, they got shot down. They got massacred. And none of the military who did this were ever prosecuted. And that was one of the complaints against our man.
When are you, this diatribe of yours, when are you going
to... I wanted to kind of give my little diatribe about the sequence. You may then correct me.
Okay.
And this guy's name, I want to make sure I don't keep screwing up. Masri, is that right?
Morsi.
Okay.
Morsi.
Sorry, Morsi. I don't mean to screw up your name. So Morsi then took power after a democratic election, in the sense that it was, it was in the middle of a revolutionary situation. It was in the middle of a military dictatorship, and it was done by with a bunch of disorganized opposition people, scheming old Mubarak people who were still trying to retake power. They were elected. This guy got elected. And he didn't prosecute any of the military people that were engaged. He tried to form he unsuccessfully tried to make friends with the military. And the military bided its time, and when it became clear that he was really screwing up, both in terms of the economy, he was courting the IMF and other groups like that, as I guess a lot of these leaders do.
Yeah.
He was thrown out by the people.
Okay, so can I say...
And the military took control.
Yeah.
Okay, now correct my narrative or add to it.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to correct.
Okay, sure, go ahead.
So, let's see. Well, first off, let's talk a little bit about what generally referred to as neoliberalism.
Okay.
Neoliberalism is the economic policy that's supported by every U.S. administration, be it... Republican or Democrat. It's really the flip side of the coin of neoconservatism. Neoconservatism generally wants direct intervention to enforce the neoliberal regimes that we have installed, install neoliberal regimes, which basically implement the policies of the banksters, of the IMF and the World Bank and the
They balance the budget on the backs of the
on
poor.
On the backs of the people. They want to see privatizations of the state sector. They want to see...
They gut medical care.
They want to see, elimination of state subsidies, like in Egypt, for food and fuel.
They encourage foreign investors.
They want to see the elimination or curtailment of the social safety net and social services.
Mm-hmm.
So neoliberalism, as seen throughout the world, in Latin America, in the Arab world...
California.
In Europe now, in Greece, in Italy, in Spain.
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz, and that's what with austerity here in this country is basically the same policy. That's what the Egyptian people are rebelling against, because the vast majority of the Egyptian people, 60%, live on less than $2 a day.
And have been heavily subsidized as far as bread goes.
Bread and fuel, but the neoliberal... policy is to reduce those subsidies. That's the whole idea, is to, squeeze the people ever more. Well, it got to the point where, Mubarak, let's backtrack a little bit. After Nasser died in 1970, Sadat, who, took power, was thought to be a figurehead at first, decided to consolidate power by shifting allegiance from the socialist bloc, headed by the Soviet Union at that time.
Wait a minute, I thought Nasser was non-aligned.
But he basically leaned towards the socialist bloc, got a lot of support from the Soviet Union for the construction of the Aswan Dam, which the U.S. had reneged on. And he went about, pursuing a policy nationalization of industries. And
we're talking Nasser here.
Nasser.
Right.
And he promulgated a constitution that secured women's rights and, began this whole program of subsidies and, expanding educational opportunities and on and on. But when he died prematurely at the age of 52, and Anwar Sadat took over, he immediately shifted allegiance to the U.S., and started dismantling the Nasserite regime that had been in power for the previous decade and a half. He basically purged the Nasserites from the government and became an ally of the U.S. because the U.S. was willing to fit the bill with billions of dollars in aid to the military.
And has been subsidizing them ever since.
Subsidizing it ever since.
Right.
So Sadat basically betrayed the Nasserite revolution and became a lackey of U.S. imperialism, plain and simple. And after his assassination, due to his treaty with Israel, he was followed in suit by Mubarak, who continued those policies for the next 30 years. But, those policies were ever more enforced, these neoliberal policies, which enriched the 1% and impoverished, the vast majority of Egyptians. Of course, there were compradors, those are people who, got rich by serving as, go-betweens, between the imperialists.
Middlemen.
Middlemen and whatnot. So there's a certain sector in Egypt that was very supportive of Mubarak because they were getting rich.
And the military was supportive of Mubarak.
And the military, basically, they preserved some of the prerogatives that were established under Nasser in that, they had industries that they had basically taken over and administered and which they profited from, about 30% of the Egyptian
economy. How much did these industries serve the people or mostly just the military?
Well... It served the people in the sense that it gave people employment. I mean, the military...
What industries were these, do you know?
Oh, there's a wide assortment of industries. I mean...
unlike other countries where the military doesn't usually run industries, right?
In a sense, it's a perverted extension of socialism, in that the army is part of the state sector, obviously. And if the army is controlling 30% of industrial output or economic output, well, then the state basically is controlling.
But it's not distributing it to the people.
The profits are going to the military. But those industries do supply jobs, you know, to the people. So in that sense, you know, it is of economic benefit.
But the products, products of those industries are not designed specifically to help the people, though.
In the sense that, you know, they are paid and, you know, they have job security. And
I'm not talking about the people who work there. I'm talking about what they're doing with their work, what it is creating.
Yeah,
does that go to the people?
It's creating a product of one sort or another.
Does that go to foreigners? Does it go to wealthy people?
Domestic consumption.
Does it go to mostly poor people, mostly wealthy people?
It's, basically the, you know, standard item type production. You know, you're talking about mattresses and stuff that people consume.
And so it's something is there a high profit margin kind of raked off, or is
a lot of profit goes to the military.
I mean, I'm asking you questions. I don't expect you to know the answers.
I'm not an authority on any
right.
of this.
It's a very important question.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, it is.
If you had a people's military that was providing services to the people, well, all right, so they got a lot of guns and uniforms, but if they're providing services, that's
providing
one thing.
Well, they're providing services in the sense that, you know, this is a state sector of the economy, so there's a certain stability, you know, in the employment that, you know, people,
you keep going back to the employment. I'm wondering about the products.
People want jobs.
I know they want jobs.
And the product that
they want,
they just consumer goods.
And they want decent wages.
Yeah,
and they want consumer goods
for the military,
at a price.
I'm sure you're doing better than the people who are on the street, you know, selling.
Yeah, but
cigarettes.
you're evading more. My point.
I don't understand what your point is.
My question is, first of all, are they getting decent wages? And are they have unions? I doubt it.
Well, there are unions.
Are there unions? Really?
Yeah, but, you know, they're basically...
there were unions, Steve. You're right. I was remembering talking to that old union agitator, Steve Argue.
A lot of them are state, you know, state-sponsored unions.
Right. Sort of like fascist corporate unions, that sort of
thing.
Yeah,
sort of like what we have in this country.
Yes. Well, that's... Well, here we have corrupt union bureaucracies, but
are they state-sponsored?
Would mean that they get controlled by the state.
Well, that would just, you know, semantics.
Anyway, what I'm saying is, so I'd like to know someday.
I'm just saying.
Are
that
the products the created by the military sold at such a reasonable price that they help people, or are they done primarily to profit?
Sold at a
or
price
they, you're not letting
the,
me finish. Okay. Are they sold at a price that essentially allows a sector of the military to live in great comfort while everybody else lives in, you know, a bed of shit?
I would say both.
Okay. Oh. Well, I'm not sure you can have both.
Why not?
Well, because for the 1% to live in a very, you know, wealthy situation, they kind of naturally tend to impoverish everybody else.
Well, I would say that the profit from these enterprises goes to the military.
Right.
As profit always goes to who owns the enterprise.
Right, but the question is, do they run these in a way that...
They run them in a way that they make a good profit so that they enrich themselves, but they also produce a product at a price point that the Egyptian people can...
That's my question.
Yeah, of course.
That's the question.
Otherwise, who would buy their product?
Okay.
You know, I mean,
tourists,
they don't.
Perhaps?
Yeah, we were talking about pots
those
and
pyramids. They're very, very.
About,
they're quite a tourist attraction.
And
the archaeologists who come into the country.
Military is producing, to put it simply, are pots and pans for the consumption by the mass of the Egyptian people.
Has the standard of living of the Egyptian people been raised as a consequence of the military's?
No. The living standards in Egypt have been continuously declining because of these neoliberal policies. So that that's one of the reasons for the upsurge in.
And the next question is: has the military been sympathetic to these neoliberal policies?
Yes.
Okay, so we have essentially a rapacious neoliberal military supporting the Mubarak regime when Mubarak suddenly gets tossed out by the people, but the people don't toss out the military.
Well, are the people going to toss out the military when the military have the guns and the people have basically, you know,
well,
their
sandals? Well, it's happened in some countries, you know.
Really?
Soviet Union?
During a war.
Well, I'm talking about 1989 and 1990.
Well, there, that's a totally different
and Poland,
story.
Yeah, and Czechoslovakia.
That's a whole other topic.
What I'm saying is that I guess here.
The Soviet Union basically committed suicide.
Well, let's. I'd like to know more of your thoughts on that.
I have lots of thoughts.
Well, I bet you do.
Yeah.
And I'm interested. I really am.
Yeah.
But again, getting back to the question, the fundamental question I have, and the reason I've been calling this a coup and a people's uprising is I'm concerned that the people's uprising is being betrayed by the military.
Well,
and
look,
that is my question to you.
Okay, let me go into my diatribe.
Please,
okay.
Go for it.
So the military, of course, wanted to preserve public order, as is their, due.
Keep their factories running.
Yeah, keep their factories running.
Keep
but also,
that U.S. money
call
coming in,
for,
right?
You know, stability. You can't have economic development or whatnot without stability.
I don't think you're looking for economic development.
So, I mean, that's you can their make an argument for, the need to have stability. Of course, that goes against the revolutionary sentiments of the people at that time. So there was repression of the revolutionary youth.
60,000 people jailed.
Most of them have been released.
And this is not under Mubarak.
This is not
after Mubarak was thrown out.
The military ceded power to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are sworn enemies. The military and the Muslim Brotherhood had always been at loggerheads with one another. There was no love lost between them, but the military did cede power to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Did they cede power under threat of another uprising?
No.
I mean, was there a lot of sentiment in the country to have an election, even if it might mean the Brotherhood would win?
Well, there was obviously pathway or whatever. A roadmap is the term they use. A roadmap for having these series of elections for the Constituent Assembly. For the presidency, there were, basically rounds of elections. And there was a lot of infighting and jockeying for position. And as mentioned, the Muslim Brotherhood being very experienced in all this and basically having, the means to organize and implement a strategy, were able to maneuver themselves into positions of power. When they did get power, they stacked, the Constitutional Assembly, which was writing a new constitution, and they basically pushed others out of the process. So it really alienated a lot of people. Because they did not, they said they were going to consult with the opposition, and they did not, and they basically imposed their vision of an Islamist society.
But not Sharia law.
Many aspects of Sharia law were put into the Constitution, and it really was against the wishes of the majority of Egyptian people, as can be attested to by the revolutionary upsurge that we've just witnessed, where twice as many people were out in the streets protesting Mosni and the Muslim Brotherhood than protested Mubarak.
Right, but the point is there are numerous groups that joined in that jamboree, not just fiery revolutionaries concerned about the interests of the people, but what they call...
Of course you're going to have...
The deep state...
The deep state,
which isn't just the military. It has to do with all the judges that Mubarak appointed, the people independently of the military who had an economic interest in returning to Mubarak regime.
Are there millions of people of that sort?
No, but there are people with some influence and power control media.
I'm talking about millions of people in the streets. They're not all judges and politicians.
No, I think very few of them probably are.
Yeah. So where are all these millions, twice the number as participated in the first revolutionary upsurge?
You had a situation a couple years later when there was less subsidies for people to eat,
and the economy was falling
because they were bungling the economy,
just like Mubarak and just like El Bar. Faraday, which is the liberal bourgeois alternative that's being pushed now, they're all in the same hip pocket of the U.S. They are all parties to this neoliberalism.
You can't be criticizing Obama, can you?
Obama? I'm talking about U.S. imperialism. He just happens to be the current figurehead.
But aren't you proud? Well, I won't get into it. I'm sorry.
Look.
Yes.
It doesn't matter, be it Mubarak. If Mubarak, you know, we were very happy, we, in terms of, you know, not you and I, but we as a nation, and we are culpable as living here. So, you know, it's legitimate to say we as a people, as a nation, we support Mubarak for 30 years because he does our bidding. And we're perfectly comfortable with his repressive regime, which is a police state. We have no problems with it because...
Mubarak and the military.
Well, Mubarak is the military, and the military is Mubarak. It's, you know, it's part and parcel of the same thing, but we were perfectly happy with that arrangement for 30 years, and there was no question that we would continue in that vein, except that the people intervened and said, well, we've had enough of this bullshit, right?
Similar to the Occupy movement. Isn't it?
Very much so, and it was a source of inspiration for the Occupy movement.
Correct.
Well, what was the alternative that the Egyptian people had at that point? Well, the left, the revolutionary left, was a very small, almost insignificant force in Egypt at that time, and there's a long history for why that may be.
And now?
I think they're gaining, because what's happened is that the Egyptian, Obama goes there prior to the election and is extolling democracy, bourgeois democracy, free and fair elections, rule of law. And this is, you know, this whets the people's appetite. He leads them to believe if you can, you know, have free and fair elections, you can elect people to represent you who are going to change your lot in life. Well, is that really going to happen? When the fair and free elections are basically rigged and arranged by the powers that be, by the 1%, and those rule, you know, those the rule of law, what does that mean? When the law is being basically written by the IMF and the EU and the World Bank, they're the ones that are determining, you know, what's right and what's wrong. So the Egyptian people are faced with this dilemma, you know, who are they, who's going to represent their interests? Is it going to be the Muslim Brotherhood? Is it going to be these liberal politicians like El Baradei? Well, the choice that they're eventually presented with is either the old regime or Mosni, you know, from the Muslim Brotherhood. And enough people opt for Mosni as at least an alternative to what they had, thinking it might be for the better. It turns out that Mosni is also basically implementing the very same neoliberal policy. And the subsidies are scheduled to be cut, and the, you know, privatizations are still, you know, scheduled to continue. The very same policies that, you know, economic policies that had impoverished the Egyptian people were being implemented
with,
by Mosni.
Of course, the added drawback of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Their attacks on women, their attacks on non-Muslims, on Copts, on secular, segments of the population. So the people are totally disillusioned with Mosni and the Muslim Brotherhood. Not only are they pursuing the same neoliberal policies, but they're also imposing a strict Islamic regime, which goes counter to the sentiments of the somewhat more cosmopolitan nature of Egyptian society.
Plus, they are not prosecuting the military.
Yeah, they're colluding with the army. They're not prosecuting
military people who killed the revolutionaries.
Exactly. So now there's, but the U.S., when Mosni was in power, well, okay, we can't have Mubarak anymore. Well, this Mosni guy, he's not all that bad. He's doing what we ask him to do. So we would be perfectly happy.
Didn't they open the border, though, on the Gaza area?
Oh, there's a whole story about them flooding the tunnels and doing all sorts of things to restrict Hamas. Even though Hamas is the scion of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, they are the descendant. They are part of the Muslim Brotherhood. But Mosni knew where, you know,
his bread was buttered,
where the writing on the wall, whatever the phrase is. You know, he knew where the bread was being buttered, so he played up to, you know, U.S. foreign policy as well. Okay, so now the Egyptian people are saying, enough is enough. We're not going to take this anymore. And they are, you know, out in the streets in massive numbers, pleading for the military to intervene and throw these, you know, fascists, these Nazis, out of office. And the military obliges. Now they're organizing new elections, a new roadmap, because the military doesn't want to be there in the catbird seat. You know, they want to be in the background, reaping in their profits. They don't want to be seen as the leading force in Egyptian politics. They want to manipulate things from behind the
scenes. But they certainly don't want a revolution.
No, that's what I'm saying. But they don't want to be seen as, you know,
their puppets up there. So, yeah. What's
so
the difference?
Now the thing is, okay, now the Egyptian people have seen through the facade of Mubarak. They've seen through the facade of Mosni and the Muslim Brotherhood. They know that they are not friends of the people. They are enemies of the people.
Well,
so now, what's the next alternative? What's the next fallback position for the neoliberal agenda for U.S. imperialism and, you know, NATO and all of that? The fallback position is Al-Baradi and the bourgeois, liberal, democratic, you know, establishment. And that's what's being promoted now, because it's the last best chance for neoliberalism to survive in Egypt. So what's going to happen now? And you're seeing it right before our eyes. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain,
Kuwait,
pumping billions upon billions upon billions of dollars into Egypt. Now, tourism generated $12 billion in revenue in Egypt during, you know, normal times. $12 billion in revenue, okay? Guess how much has already been contributed to Egypt from these potentates?
$8 billion, I heard.
No, it's up to $20
billion. Oh, really?
$20 billion, covering all the losses from tourism plus some. So what's this going to allow? This is going to allow the military to, again, you know, step back, put forward these neoliberal, you know, bourgeois, you know, Democrats like Al-Baradei with this substantial treasure chest of funds that are going to be able to placate the masses, you know, maintain the subsidies. So, okay, so the neoliberal agenda will be put on hold to, you know, dampen down the revolutionary fervor of the masses, you know, bread and, you know,
and circuses.
And right. Circuses, mm-hmm. Right? So that's their strategy now. You know, the people have risen up in anger, and they have seen, through the facade of these supposed, you know, saviors. But now, you know, the people, they just want bread on the table, you know? They want to be able to live a halfway decent life. Revolution for them is, you know, a day's wage and a cup of beer and some rice in the pot. I mean,
you're thinking of China, I think.
Egypt as well.
Rice, really?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah, they eat rice.
And it was wheat.
Well, wheat, whatever it is. Yeah. But no matter. You get the gist of what I'm saying, right?
I do.
So I think that strategy is really going to work. Because, you know, the demands of the people will have been met, which is stop cutting the fuel subsidies, stop cutting the food subsidies. You know, give us maybe up our wages a little bit. Give us a roof over our heads, you know. You know, the Egyptian people are really impoverished, and, you know, the powers that be realize that, you know, the jig is up. You know, they gotta come up with a little bit, you know, to keep the masses, you know,
unrevolutionary.
Quiet, placated, so that they will retreat from the brink.
TV sets, daytime serials.
But, so, you know, how long is this going to last? You know, I mean, the monarchists and whatnot, I mean, they're not going to just continuously dole out the funds. You know, this is an emergency situation. They're going to see Egypt through for the next couple of years. But the people have learned a lot. You know, they're going to see through Al-Baradei when those neoliberal policies are reimposed down the line. And they're going to know that they're not going to get anything from the Mubaraks or the Mosnis or the Al-Baradeis. And hopefully it will give the left, the true revolutionaries, the breathing room to basically galvanize their forces and assemble a true revolutionary leadership, just like in Russia in 1905 and 1917. There was the aborted 1905 mm-hmm. revolution, but it did bring to the fore a coterie of revolutionaries who eventually led the 1917 revolution. So I would see a true revolution that could succeed down the line, maybe not this year or next year, maybe a decade down the line. But the forces have been set in motion. And another thing I just want to mention is that the army is an army of the people in the sense that, it has a dual sort of character. Its origins, in the Nasserite regime, forged great unity with the people, and then it was betrayed and became basically, an overseer. But the people still look to the army as an embodiment of the nation, and there may be young Turks, so to speak, in the army, progressive, Korea army people, sort of like what we've seen in South America with Hugo Chavez and others who attempted to seize control militarily but then stood for elections. Maybe down the line there will be a military figure who steps forth who can basically mobilize the revolutionary sectors of society and win election in a fair and free election. As you are so much in favor of. So that's the way I see these things, possibly, one possible scenario.
An interesting vision and one that I don't, really disagree with. There's a long article by a guy called Issam Al-Amin, who's the author of The Arab Awakening Unveiled, Understanding Transformations and Revolutions in the Middle East, which I think I downloaded from one of your favorite websites. I think it was Counterpunch, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Might have been another one.
Mm-hmm.
He writes, in Egypt, the military is supreme, which I think you probably agree with.
Yeah.
He does, however, give some more detail. One of the big issues has been, and it's not a big issue for me, but for many it is, for some it is, the legitimacy overthrowing a democratic government, however much there was a faulty process of election. It was more of an election than they ever had in Egypt, as far as I know. Maybe unless you've got some other... And I'm not saying elections are the be-all or the end-all. And they can often be the way, as you say, of covering the neoliberal policies. But, in fact, also it can also be a way, to some extent, of expressing the people's will, insofar as they're able to. And, of course, in this country, you can't. And I guess there you couldn't either, because you just have no choice. Tweedledee or Tweedledum. But there's a concern that, as you know... And I keep hearing this, it doesn't really mean that much to me because I think legitimacy is also conveyed by people rising and standing up for their rights and standing up for their needs. But that's one of the things that is being repeated again and again by those who are
saying
this is a legitimate...
It's making a fetish of elections.
Yeah.
I think, the Muslim Brotherhood lost their legitimacy because of, the way they tried to...
The same
to
way the Turkish prime minister lost his legitimacy?
Is losing his legitimacy.
So, Obama, of course, will maintain his legitimacy throughout.
Not as far as
perhaps
I'm concerned.
His illegitimacy,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, you can't superimpose our history of democratic, politics on a country like Egypt. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The circumstances are so entirely different. And I think this is part of a process. Now, democratic elections, I mean, they were democratic in the sense that there was a choice, have been held in Egypt. There's been a whole process established. And they are going about, basically implementing another round of democratic elections, whereby, this process will continue to unfold and consolidate. So that I think it's a very good thing that, this process is occurring, because it does educate the people as to who are their friends and who are their enemies. And eventually, as in Venezuela, as in Ecuador, as in Bolivia, process of democratization, if the proper revolutionary leadership emerges, and it can emerge from the military, you know, young Turks, you know, people, younger, you know, officers who are imbued with a revolutionary perspective because of their experiences in the mass movement. You know, they might emerge in the military to take leadership and present a candidate, or maybe a candidate of the left will emerge in some other fashion. It's much easier for a candidate of the left, as in South America, to emerge from the military. They have the discipline, they have the know-how to organize people and organize a mass movement. So it's not to totally discount the military. As I say, it has a dual character, as the protector of the Egyptian nation, but also as the oppressor of the Egyptian nation. And this duality is very common. Things are not, you know, always, you know, black and white. We have to look to see, you know, sort of the yin and the yang here, you know.
That's your Chinese scholarship coming in again. We're talking with Dennis Edler, who's he's not a Chinese archaeologist, but he's an archaeologist who speaks Chinese.
I'm an archaeologist who has done all of his work in China. So in that sense, you could say I'm a Chinese archaeologist, but not of Chinese extraction.
I got you. Well, I'm going to read a little bit of this to you and ask for your thoughts. This is, again, this article I mentioned to you before. It's by this, it's called In Egypt, the Military is Supreme. I'm just going to read a selection or two because it talks about some of the specific history of the last 2 years, which I think is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The military in Egypt has always enjoyed a privileged, as you were saying, an autonomous status and is tacitly considered the power behind the throne. For decades, political power was concentrated in the hands of an elite, yet mostly corrupt political and business class that monopolized power and looted the country's resources. But the revolution that toppled... If at some point you object, by the way... The revolution that toppled Mubarak was in essence a rejection not just against the dictator, but also his entire corrupt regime. One of the major demands of the revolution was to get rid of the dictatorship and repression and uphold the principles of democracy and the rule of law. Although we might want to add, bread on the table would be nice.
I think that, you know, that that meme or trope, whatever, democracy and the rule of law, you know, which was promoted by Obama in his speech.
Not to mention
in Cairo,
George W. Bush in Iraq.
George W. Bush is you know, very deceptive. I mean, it sounds very nice, and it's really a false consciousness, as far as I'm concerned. Because, as mentioned, you know, the type of elections that are, you know, basically held, and the you know, who makes the laws that are, you know, ruling.
Manufacturer of consent.
Generally, when the, you know, elections at this stage in the game, when they're held, you know, the ground rules and the laws have been established by the very people who, you know, you're trying to replace, you know, so
that's
it's stacked against, you know, the people.
Continuing with this article.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next 2 years, the political process that followed Mubarak's overthrow allowed for the will of the Egyptian people to be expressed numerous times through free and fair elections and referenda.
Business of free and fair elections, I think that's been critiqued.
You've already spoken about that. People in Egypt went to the polls at least 6 times to vote for a referendum to chart the political way forward, March 2011, to vote for the lower and upper houses of parliament, November 2011, January 2012, to elect a civilian president over 2 rounds, May and June 2012, and to ratify the new constitution, December 2012.
Yeah, well, that's all obviously all very true. I mean, because it's just a matter of objective historical fact.
Right.
You know, these elections did occur.
Right.
No one can deny that they happened.
But you're saying they weren't that significant.
I'm not saying they weren't significant.
In the sense that there was no choice for the people.
I'm just saying that they were manipulated, they were skewed, they were not really representative of the sentiment of the people. You know, choices that were made were under duress.
Okay. Each time the electorate voted for the choice of the Islamic parties to the frustration of the secular and liberal opposition.
Well, obviously, Mosni and the Muslim Brotherhood did gain the presidency and a majority in the Constituent Assembly. Again, it's a matter of historic record. You know, you can't deny that this happened. But, you know, there are reasons why they were able to do that against the current will of the people. Many people, you know, kind of, you know, thought, well, maybe, maybe.
But at that time, we considering it probably was the hope of the people.
It was the hope of the people that maybe, fingers crossed, that the Muslim Brotherhood will, you know, basically do as they said. But I can tell you one thing. The Muslim Brotherhood has lied and deceived throughout its history.
Not the Muslim Brotherhood.
No, not the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's not surprising that they went against what they said. You know, they fell back on their word.
Continuing. To the discontent of the Islamists, all their gains at the polls were reversed by either the Mubarak-appointed Supreme Constitutional Court or the military. The lower house of parliament, of which the Islamists won 73% of the seats, was dissolved by the Supreme Constitutional Court a year ago, while the military has just suspended the new constitution while ousting the democratically elected president.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, the words, you know, sort of the vocabulary being used is...
These are true facts.
These are true facts. But it is papering over the backstory. I mean, there's a lot of history, recent history, that goes into all of these.
All right, let's talk about these incidents. 73% of the seats were won in the lower house of parliament.
You can go to Wikipedia. Right. You can go to Egypt, you know, 2011 Egyptian revolution. You can read through all the shenanigans and manipulation and exigencies that occurred that led to
you were
those
following
results.
This when it happened.
Oh yeah.
Okay, let me continue with this.
No.
Undoubtedly, the Muslim Brotherhood committed colossal mistakes. For example, they reneged on several promises to their secular and liberal coalition partners, including to not contest the majority of parliamentary seats, field a presidential candidate, or exclude others in the composition of the Constituent Assembly.
Yeah, so what is that saying? Can you interpret that?
They lied.
They cheated. They did everything.
They changed their minds.
They changed their minds. What they did was deceive people into thinking that they would act in one way, and they acted exactly counter to that, basically to weasel their way into power. So that, can you imagine if they were in power for 3 more years? Do you think the Muslim Brotherhood would ever, relinquish power? On their own accord.
Well, this is an issue where I may disagree with you. Although you seem to have more confidence that the military will relinquish power than the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I have confidence that the military will relinquish control to another
satellite group.
Segment.
So they're not really relinquishing.
They're not relinquishing power.
See, my concern is that the Muslim Brotherhood, how much you may not like them, was a counterforce to the military.
No. Not at all.
Well,
they were seeking to accommodate the military.
Right. No, when they were in power, they were.
Yeah.
But out of power, they were a counterforce to the military. And now, out of power, they are still a counterforce that is being jailed by the military.
They were being jailed before. They were outlawed by...
Not in the last 2 years.
Wow.
And that's what we're talking about. That's what I'm talking about.
So, the thing is, when they had, quote, legitimacy, when they were involved in the political process, they used it to their own advantage, to the exclusion of...
I'm not defending the military.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, if you want to see revolutionary power triumph, you need to make sure that you don't put a bunch of anti-revolutionaries, either the Muslim Brotherhood or the military, in power. You need to keep balancing these off. You need to establish counterforces.
Nobody is in a position to do that. Think of me as a modern-day Henry Kissinger. You can't just wish it to be that way. The people don't have any power other than their masses in the streets, but they can't keep that up ad infinitum, particularly if there's billions of dollars pouring into the economy to basically, you know...
buy them off.
Disperse, you know, the revolutionary momentum. So the people... Look, there's an old saying, and it goes something like this. Political power grows out of the barrel
Didn't
of a gun.
Some commies say that?
But it's true.
Mao Zedong or Mao Zedong or Mousky Palsky.
Whatever you
one of those
think
old guys,
of whomever said it,
yes.
It just happens to be true. And you have to admit that is
you're not
true.
A flower power kind of guy.
Yeah,
right?
No, I'm just being realistic.
Let me read some more.
I'm just
this.
Being realistic, and it's the military that has the guns, and you know they're going to maintain their power until.
My point, though, is that if you have the Muslim Brotherhood and the opposition and not repressed, it's a better counterforce to the military.
No, because
provided
the,
it's not in power.
What the Muslim Brotherhood wants to do and what they were attempting to do is to entrench themselves in power so they could not be dislodged and eventually take control
I'm
of
not,
the military.
I'm not, you're misunderstanding. I'm not defending necessarily the regime that they had. I'm saying that I am attacking the idea that it's a great thing for the military to be repressing the Muslim Brotherhood.
I think it is.
Yeah, see, well, that's the idea I'm taking. I think
it would have been a great thing if the Wehrmacht, or whatever it was called back then, had repressed the Nazis.
Well, it depends. The Nazis out of power are not the same thing as the Nazis in power. But the Nazis are a different issue than the Muslim Brotherhood.
I think the closest analogy
so they were
of the Muslim
big
Brotherhood
friends
is
during the
Nazis.
Second World War.
Yeah,
I
the
admit.
Muslim Brotherhood models themselves after the National Socialists of Germany. I mean, they do.
But they don't use the same symbols anymore. I mean,
well, it's not a matter of symbolism. It's a matter of practice.
Indeed. Yeah. So what I'm saying is I don't think that repressing people in that way.
I would much rather have had the Nazis be repressed.
I'm talking about the Muslim Brotherhood.
And I'd much rather have the Muslim Brotherhood repressed.
Well, obviously you would.
Yeah.
But the fact
and
that
the Egyptian people would as well. In their massive numbers assembled in Tahrir Square and throughout Egypt.
Well, it looks, it does
they
look.
They got 25 million people, twice the number of
people. It doesn't matter that they came
out. Signing a petition
to get it's not
to
that
them
they
more.
Came out. I don't think they would support shooting down Muslim Brotherhood people and jailing them once they're out of power.
No, they do.
Well, that's a good question.
They do.
And you know this because of your...
Because of what I've seen and read and heard.
Well, it certainly is true that... It certainly
people
is,
are celebrating
it certainly
still
is,
in the streets.
Right, they're celebrating the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not.
And they know very well the fate that lies in store for the Muslim Brotherhood once they're overthrown, which is that they are... basically, the leadership is, detained and thrown in jail.
Detained? How nice. You mean like the Guantanamo people are detained?
Well, detained, arrested, whatever term you want to use. The Egyptian people, in their masses, are very happy to see the Muslim Brotherhood get their
I don't think I haven't seen evidence of that. I've seen evidence that the military likes to do it. I've seen evidence that the media is big in favor of it. And I've seen evidence that they like the fact that the Brotherhood was thrown out.
They're not. I can tell you. There's no sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood except amongst the ranks of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
And what percentage of the country do you think... So you're saying that the support that the Muslim Brotherhood has, let's say, not to be jailed, is very little? Everyone wants the Muslim Brotherhood jailed and shot down in Egypt?
I don't think you're going to see many more massacres of the sort that we just saw, which is a one-on-one situation.
Friday is coming up. It's Ramadan.
I mean, the military... As I mentioned, in many countries, in allies, where we tend to not really give it a second thought, in Guatemala, in wherever
I
else.
Give it a second thought, I resent the fact that you do this.
No, we. I'm talking about the U.S. government.
Right.
The U.S. government does not give it a second thought.
What does that have to do with anything, though?
I'm just saying this is not something that is... So out of the ordinary, it's just par for the course. So I mean, you seem to be extremely incensed.
Look, if you saw the Muslim Brotherhood shooting down revolutionaries, you'd be screaming at the top of your voice. But you don't give a shit if the Muslim Brotherhood gets shot down. I don't go for that. I think that's a double standard.
No,
I think
it's not a double standard.
To me,
it's a matter
like
of
double standard.
You got to look to see what these what the Muslim Brotherhood represents. And it represents everything that the Egyptian people are against. They don't want
people. Sounds like a demonization.
They should be demonized because you know what they do? They accost women who don't wear the veil. Okay? I mean,
some of them do.
They rape women at demonstrations to intimidate and humiliate them.
They attack and kill.
I've got
cops.
An article here about that, but I've not.
They do all sorts of.
And you know that individuals who specifically are Muslim Brotherhood people have been doing this. You have some evidence of that before you make this claim here on the.
Yeah,
air.
I have the evidence of what I.
I mean, the polls say that 93% of the Egyptian people, or maybe Egyptian men, think that the women shouldn't be complaining. That there's a massive sexist attitude throughout the Egyptian population. That has nothing to do specifically with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's a function of the culture.
But the Muslim Brotherhood are the ones that basically implement, practice, you know, not only ideologically.
What's your source on this? What's your source?
Oh, come on. There's lots of documentary evidence of this all over the web.
I have not specifically seen evidence that particularly...
I have.
Okay, well, then you should send that to me.
I will.
Okay. Yeah. We'll be continuing this debate for the next 14 years. So I continue reading this?
I read the same thing.
I know. Maybe, but, of course, people haven't heard it. And no doubt nobody really gives a shit. But I find it interesting to discuss. So, we talked about the mistakes of the Muslim Brotherhood. Perhaps their gravest ally was to ally themselves closely with the Salafist groups during the process of writing the Constitution, thus alienating many of the secularist liberals as well as Christians. Salafists, of course, are the extreme people who are even worse than the Muslim Brotherhood as far as Islamic fundamentalism goes, right?
Well, they want to see a total implementation
right.
of Sharia law.
So aren't
law.
These the people that are really going to be ripping the clothes off women? How do you know it's not them and the Muslims? See, this whole bullshit that I hear that you have this evidence. I don't believe you.
I believe what I read when these accounts.
Anyway,
are
the military has formed an alliance that is now in question with these extreme fundamentalist Islamists in order to
the military. No, not the military.
Yeah.
No.
Well, the military that is appointing the new government had the Salafists.
No. You're wrong on that score. Morsi. And the Muslim Brotherhood was seeking an alliance with
they
the
Salafists. They had an alliance with them, but if you look on the...
It's the Dawah Party, which is not the Salafists. It's another conservative Muslim faction.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because, well, then I'm getting the wrong information from my reading here. Maybe you're...
The Salafists, I haven't seen any indication that the current military...
So explain to the audience who the Salafists are.
Salafists
people are wondering, we're talking about the aliens.
Basically... to the right, even, of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, they are...
You'd rather have the Muslim Brotherhood than the Salafists?
No.
You don't want either of them?
I don't want either.
You don't like the Nazis? What do you got against Hitler, anyway? Never, we won't get into that. So, again, this is talking about
The guy's an apologist for the Muslim Brotherhood. It's obvious. He's trying to paint the picture in the brightest colors to, basically...
I think there's truth to what you're saying, sure. But he also raises issues that you glide over very quickly.
I don't
quickly.
Glide over them.
Well, that's why I'm bringing them up. I want to make sure you address them.
I don't need to glide over them. I just think it's obvious that the masses of Egyptian people... are against the Muslim Brotherhood and how they've conducted themselves and the policies.
Well, let's see if we have any Muslim Brotherhood fans in the audience. Will all you Muslim Brotherhood fans please give us a call at 427-3772, or possibly people who are finding this conversation so arcane that they're about to turn off the radio. We don't even have a radio. We're not going on the radio.
Well, we could go on to some other topics.
Yeah, we could. I think it might be appropriate.
I think we've kind of beaten this door.
I think I should talk to you about it probably more off air because my interests are probably not, they're rather specialized in this. I do appreciate your getting as specific as possible in your.
Well, I'm just following things as they break. I mean, this is not my area of expertise.
I understand.
Far, I can't speak to specific.
We have that wild and crazy Chinese archaeologist who's not really of Chinese descent, but he's. In his work in China, Dennis Etler, who's also recently been a big supporter of the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. Where's that going, Dennis? Is it disappeared
well,
entirely?
Sort of a lull, I mean, as it will be. there's no... there are lots of issues. My God, there's 101 issues to be addressed. But, these sorts of movements have their ups and downs, and, there just doesn't seem to be the motivation for people to get out and do what they were doing a year or so ago. And, of course, there was a severe repression
of the Occupy movement.
Which continues. We have, you know, the Santa Cruz 11 who will be going back to court next month, and then to trial in September. And there recently was this benefit, mainly for the Sanctuary movement, but also for the Santa Cruz 11.
And I think the powers that be here locally and across the nation were very successful in clamping down on the Occupy movement and intimidating people and demoralizing them. With the disbursement of encampments and the persecution and prosecution of activists. And it did disperse the energy.
Oh, yeah. And frightened a lot of people.
Frightened a lot of people. I mean, they're very well schooled in, these sorts of
tactics,
endeavors and tactics, going back to COINTELPRO and whatnot. It's not as if they've been sitting on the hands for the last dozen or more years.
Has been, of course, an explosion of information about surveillance society stuff, thanks to people like Edward Snowden and earlier Bradley Manning.
I would love to see another, whistleblower.
Perhaps a Santa Cruz whistleblower?
Well, someone who would expose, the machinations of local, state, and federal authorities in their, conniving to, turn back the tide of Occupy activism.
Yeah, and of course, what we've got instead are Public Records Act requests where we try to get information. And we have courts that are refusing to convict people, and we have, DAs that can't even draw together, four sides of an indictment because there's nothing to indict except possibly a sausage or
a ham sandwich. I mean, I'm sure there must have been collusion at some higher, level of authority,
An actual phone call. It's probably the phone company. It's threatening to turn off our phone service. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Dennis and Robert.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing this evening?
Good, good. I think this is Mrs. L, if I'm not mistaken.
That would be, you're not mistaken.
Okay, I want to let the audience know that this show, which normally talks about homeless issues, and it was completely diverted into Egypt, thanks to my ongoing tirade here. I know you haven't been listening because you don't have a radio, right, Mrs. L?
I have no computer.
Right, and you have no computer. Actually, the radio wouldn't help you because we aren't broadcasting. Good point.
There you go.
Although,
sorry.
No, that's okay. But you, I know you spoke to me earlier, and you said you wanted to talk a bit about an inspirational homeless account that you or experience you had?
Well, okay. Yeah. Let me see what you think about this. How you feel about this. Okay, if I may share.
Please,
my son and I were at an event in downtown Santa Cruz, and we stopped at McDonald's to have a bite on our way home. This was back in December. And, we're sitting there eating, and some pretty well-heeled young men come in. They're maybe 20 years old, young 20s. And they seem to be a little inebriated, and they're making disparaging remarks about people in the lower income brackets, homeless people, just making some real disparaging remarks very loudly. And there were quite a few people in McDonald's, and it was, I was pretty uncomfortable with the situation. But as it turned out, I'm the only one who could, I guess, clearly see one of these three young men as they were yucking it up. And one of them started choking on his French fries until he got to the point where he was not breathing. His face was turning blue or some unnatural color. And so I see this happening, and I yell at his two friends, give him the effing Heimlich, right? So I yell it really loud. And his friends just stood there. They were just paralyzed. They were totally useless. A woman gets up, runs over there, gives him the Heimlich. He's fine, saved his life. And then you see her leave, pedal off into the night with her belongings.
Homeless-looking person, in other words.
Obviously homeless.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
you know, here they've been making the disparaging remarks regarding, you know, people of so-called lower class and homelessness, et cetera, and
did they share their fries with this woman? Did they buy her a burger or offer a blanket or anything else?
They did nothing. They seemed a bit contrite afterwards, but no. I think the only thing that happened is that I have a story that I can share with people.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, and it's often been said by particularly people who are poor that they notice that the poorer you are, the more likely people are to share stuff with you. That there's more generosity among folks in the lower classes, maybe because they know what it's like, maybe because they feel they have less to lose. Although, you know, I can also notice that there can be a lot of theft back and forth, too, that can happen. That happened a lot at the Occupy camp, I think, in the San Lorenzo Park, I was told. So, yeah, I mean, it's you know, I think the more the demeaning of people who are poor on the streets, the suggesting that they shouldn't be around because they're somehow a menace, really misreads the situation entirely. It's not only, you know, a form of bigotry that pisses me off. It's a form of really misperception of human beings that ignores their the reality of what they are in terms of even in the social context, what they can do, the value of having people around is there are people more people around, even if they're poor. There's less likelihood that people are going to rob shops nearby or break into, you know, this or that or fight with each other. Insofar as there is a more engaged community. What's your thoughts on this, Dennis? Any thoughts of any sort?
Well, no, I agree completely with everything you said. No, I agree completely. I mean, it's a very moving story. I appreciate the caller for sharing it with us.
Yeah. So there.
Yeah, yeah, just because you're in a situation doesn't mean squat. You know? Yeah, it doesn't classify you. It doesn't, yeah. You know, I've been homeless. You know, so, you know, I can speak from the perspective of being homeless myself. And I didn't do anything illegal. And, you know, but you know what? There's always going to be a few in any sector of the world, any place you go, anything. There's going to be a few that spoil it for everyone else.
You know, I hate that metaphor because I don't think the few are spoiling it for everyone else. I think it's the view of people who are looking in who don't understand what it means to be poor. And when they see, you know, a few people acting in ways they don't like or that are just, you know, demonstrably bad, they then start blaming the entire class. I don't blame the people.
Yeah, but one other thing that has to be mentioned.
No, that's what I'm saying. If there are a few people that behave in a manner that...
No, but I'm saying that we shouldn't blame those people. We should blame the class above them that then, you know, regards those people as somehow exemplative of that class. Those are the people I blame, because those are the people in power who are misreading or opportunistically and intentionally misdescribing the situation.
Yeah, and those people are the people in power, the people on the city council, the people in the media who stigmatize
the police
and spread, you know, these sorts of ideas about you know, the poor and the homeless being basically beyond the pale and not worthy of respect. You got to look at the establishment.
It's a false metaphor to say one bad apple ruins the barrel. It's not the bad apple that ruins the barrel.
No. I don't say that they ruin the barrel. I mean, it destroys the perspective of people.
See, I disagree with you, I think. I mean, I hear what you're saying. You're saying that you know, these few people create a bad impression.
People's perspective of a group can be influenced by just one or two people's actions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's
okay.
True.
Okay.
But I think...
That's what I mean.
Yeah, but I think that the people who are in the group that is protected and is privileged and is housed has to realize that these, that, you know, there's a much larger group of people that they are denouncing when they assume that the few people that, that are acting badly exemplify the group. So while you can say, see, I don't want to say those people ruin it for the group. It's the people who are watching who assume those people are typical who ruin it. They are the ones who are doing it.
Right. Okay, that's true.
You know, because otherwise we turn against each other. You know, that's the problem.
You're right.
And I think, frankly, a lot of the bad behavior is created by the repressive circumstances people are under. If cops continually treat you like shit, there are going to be times when you're going to say, fuck you, and get angry, and, you know, act out how you feel. And that, some people may say, you know, I mean, Gandhi reportedly said he would rather see a man resisting violently than not resisting injustice at all. That was, I mean, actually, I don't know if that's apocryphal, but it's certainly a quote that's often attributed to him. I've seen it attributed a couple of times. So, you know, it's, anyway, that's my reaction to that. So there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, can I say something about the, the whole mental health system thing, too. I mean,
sure, go ahead. Say what you'd like.
Get me started on that. No. I mean, if people don't have access to, maybe meds that might be helpful to them, you know, to go ahead and fill out paperwork properly, to be able to go ahead and deal with the system and participate in whatever they might need to get for themselves and participate if they wish to, you know, and whatever they wish to participate in. I mean, if I didn't have my meds, I wouldn't be able to function. I wouldn't be able to have what I have. I'm fortunate to have a home, but without meds, no. I would probably be using alcohol, and I doubt that I would have my home.
What kind of meds do you use, or should I ask?
Oh, well, right now I'm on antidepressants.
And how long have you been taking these?
16 years.
Huh. And which antidepressants?
I'm on Effexor.
Effexor.
And I've tried to go without them, and I do not have enough, what do you call that?
Support system?
No. There's a chemical in your brain.
Serotonin?
There you go.
Yeah.
I have a lack of serotonin, is what I've been told.
More hugs, I would say, definitely.
Well, more hugs would help, too, I'm sure. But, you know, I mean, even in the short term, if somebody, I don't know, if people aren't getting what they need medically in whatever way that they need and society's not helping them and turning their back on them, I see people turning to cheap alternatives downhill.
Question.
And
yeah, we
it's
agree.
Just upsetting, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
It's just, you know, whatever, whether, you know, whether it be medical or whatever it is. And I'm very frustrated that, you know, that the paperwork for housing, the paperwork for medical, the paperwork for, you know, anything to keep yourself well and, you know, be productive and, you know, get ahead and just be plain healthy is so difficult to get.
You know,
through.
I received a call today that a woman went to the St. George Hotel. She had a guaranteed income, an SSI. She's a disabled person. She also had a housing voucher, and she was told that because and they said, well, where's your current residence? And she was imprudent enough to say, I'm homeless. And they said, well, we won't take you. And that's the kind of discrimination. Even if people have the means to pay, even if they have more so than an ordinary person with a job, they are discriminated against in this, at least at the St. George today, according to this woman's account. So I'm unhappy with this.
Very sad.
Yeah.
Very sad. Very, very sad.
Any other thoughts, Ms. L?
Not at the moment. I just, I'm happy when I see people that are, you know, struggling and that they share a good word, a good thought, you know, that they'll, you know, that people, you know, they still
care about
you
each
know,
other.
Meet yeah. eyes with you and still acknowledge you as a person and, you know, just yeah. like, you know, I just appreciate when people still keep on keeping on and keep their heads up and keep their pride and, you know, they can still do it, you know?
Me too. I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Call again.
Later, Dennis. Later, Robert. We'll
thanks.
Do.
Hey, thanks, Phil. Bye-bye.
Good night.
So I've got some interviews here, Dennis. You are tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, freakradio.org. This show is live, if you're watching or listening to it, I should say, on the 11th of July. But you better stay off the medians because it's illegal now to hold up a sign on any median or roundabout in Santa Cruz. And Dennis, I hope you, you know, walk straight and stay clean and keep those signs away from the medians or you you are going
to
get ticketed and maybe go to jail
I'll
along with your Muslim Brotherhood
narrow,
fans.
But, well, I can walk the street now on a median strip.
Yeah, you can walk across a median.
Oh, I can only
you
walk
would best not
okay.
stay there or linger too long.
Well,
for instance, I know
well,
that on
we,
the 4th of July.
Are we challenge this?
Well, if you are, I'll be happy to join you, and we can go down together, you and I.
Think we need a contingent of a few dozen people.
That would be very good. They get if we can round them up. Then, of course, what the police will do is they'll ignore us, and we'll all go home, and they'll go after people anyway who aren't there. That's we have to find
well,
some way.
I mean,
to address
there are
it.
Some groups that have weekly vigils, so we could do this on a weekly basis.
I'm up for that. In fact, if anybody, any listeners want to be a part of this kind of thing, give a call to the Huff Line, 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and we can arrange a conspiracy to commit a misdemeanor, which may be, actually it's an infraction, not a misdemeanor yet, but if you do it twice, it could be a misdemeanor. It's also illegal, of course, to use disparaging words in the parks now. If you make people feel uncomfortable with profane, abusive language, that's what I say. I say that exactly so. Let's hear some other voices before you know, the hour is completely gone, or the 2 hours are completely gone. Dennis, you're looking a little restless. You're not obliged to stay here if you're getting bored with all this
well,
stuff.
Well, I do have some places to go. And
people to meet, revolutions
yeah,
to incite, perhaps.
So, well, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed our,
yeah, well, we went back
there.
And forth. They probably could have done it in 10 minutes. We took an hour and a half.
A
but
lot of people to watching their boob tubes.
I know. They're right. We could have probably drove everybody out to get ice cream somewhere.
Yeah.
Actually, they didn't because there's not a radio. I should tell people, by the way, that we are, in fact, due to... it won't just be we'll be off the air for a limited period of time. We'll be off the air for months unless in the next 2 weeks we get a radio site for a radio transmitter. And that's because one of our main members is going on sabbatical or whatever you call it. He's traveling and he will not be around. So I encourage you to if you have any interest or energy in finding a place for us to put up an antenna. That's all we need, a place to put up an antenna. Do it now and get in touch with freakradio.org or give me a call at 423-4833. I'm gonna roll into some of these interviews, and Dennis, you're gonna take off, it looks like.
But
if you decide to want to comment on anything, I'm always your comments are to the point. And,
okay, well, we can do this again someday.
Wrong, always wrong, of course, but
it was good.
Yeah, it was good.
Appreciate it. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Hey, Dennis.
Robert?
Cheers, man.
Okay. Take care.
All right. That's Dennis Edler. And Dennis, if people want to, do you have anything online you've written, or do you want anything? Give any reference?
I do have a couple of blogs.
Mention your blog.
Okay. Well, it's on Blogger. It's one site. I forget the URL even. It's but you can probably find it. Incitatus is one site.
How do you spell that?
Incitatus. Oh, something like Incitatus. Well, you can figure it out.
Incitatus.
Yeah. And you got
we have a caller.
Well,
this might be a question for you before you go. Say, so, hi, you're on the air with the departing Dennis and Robert.
Robert, it's Dennis.
Another Dennis. Go ahead, Dennis.
I just wanted to encourage our listeners to take a chance with free radio. Put us in your backyard and get us back on the air. It's real important that free radio be a broadcast radio. We've been off the air before, but it's always, it's always been our listeners that have gotten us back on the air. And now it's time, if you're a listener to free radio, to step up. The email address is frsc@freakradio.org. That's frsc@freakradio.org. Leave us a message, and we'll get back to you. Need to be on the east side or the west side of Santa Cruz. It's close to downtown, but not in downtown. So that's what we're looking for.
Will you be coming in tonight to do your show, Dennis?
Yes, I will. I will see you in just a few minutes, Robert.
Excellent. Well, then, you'll be able to hear Dennis on the stream tonight.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. And bye-bye to the other Dennis. Thank
yes.
you, Dennis.
Yes, there are a few of us.
Incitatus.
Caligula's horse.
Caligula's horse. So maybe you should look. Google for Caligula's horse and then get Incitatus's proper spelling.
It's talktoahorse.blogger.com.
Talktoahorse.blogger. Or blogger or blogspot?
Blogspot, or whatever.
I don't know what should be. Anyway, that's you can stop horsing around and check out what Dennis has had to say.
Blog,
the man has many tentacles everywhere you look. The guy is.
Someday we can talk about human evolution. That's my specialty.
And he's perhaps going to threaten to come back and talk about human evolution at some point. So watch out.
And China.
In China and China. I mean, China is perhaps an example of human evolution. But,
okay.
Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah.
So here's some interviews from the streets that I haven't subsequently or previously played, I should say. Let's listen in.
Satisfied customers, Santa Cruz down at the Red Church. It's July 8th, around 10 after 5. We're talking with
Doc Holliday again.
Doc, what's the word? Anything new other than your continued abuse against our fair city? Or?
I think it sucks. 47 years of this town, it sucks. The cops suck. So do the yuppies.
Now, what exactly do you have against our police officers and their yuppie pal?
You just had everything.
Anything happened in the last week? Have any notes?
Nope. Not yet.
So you've been left alone?
Left alone. They don't disturb me no more.
No tickets?
No tickets. No nothing.
No humiliating looks?
I get that all the time.
Well, there you have it. I've been out to the Homeless Lack of Services Center lately.
Homeless Lack of Services?
On Coral Street.
Yeah. I went there today.
How'd that go?
It went actually pretty good.
So they actually gave you some services?
Yeah, they gave me some service.
What kind of service did you get there?
Their wonderful shower and their toilet use. That
How
was
long
about
did it take to use the poo-poo machine on the shower?
About 10 minutes.
So you didn't have a waiting line?
No.
And you didn't have to sign up on a list?
Well, I signed the list anyways.
You have to show your ID, perhaps?
No. No ID, no nothing like that.
Fingerprints?
No fingerprints.
Blood samples?
And that is now going to be apparently required to use the day services at the homeless, what I call the homeless lack of services or lack of shelter center. According to today's Sentinel, in the budget that was passed on Tuesday, with the agreement, if not the connivance, of the management of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, Monica Martinez, there is a... I want to find the article, and I will actually quote, hopefully, directly from it. There is a specific requirement... that you get, they're going to be putting in a gate at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, and there's going to be a ID requirement, which I guess I heard Steve Plaich suggest was might be a positive thing because it would help people who want to get ID get ID. And I do not have the article here, but... I think it's some $50,000 has been appropriated, something like that, for this new anti-homeless device for further screening out and excluding under the the mythology of public safety, homeless people. It's requiring ID for services like food is something that has never been the case in Santa Cruz and never should be the case in Santa Cruz, but is now apparently going to be standard operating procedure. Unless, of course, enough people stand up and say no thanks, similar to these new anti-homeless laws that are going into effect today, prohibiting you from being on a median unless you're walking directly through, similar to being, can't be in a parking lot or parking garage unless you're either parking your vehicle or walking directly through. And you can't be in a park if you are offending some middle-class person with your language. And then you have to be, you're subjected even before any kind of conviction with a stay-away order for a day, just on the say-so of yuppie watchers from outside who want to purify their parks. It has to be said, I have been getting complaints. Well, I've heard of complaints. I heard that Rosemary Chalmers of KSCO was denouncing the scene down at the San Lorenzo Park. I asked her to do an exchange with me on the show on this issue and talk about it some more. She told me she'd get back to me on that. We'll see if that happens. I went to Trader Joe's yesterday, and as I chatted with a family of five outside, two twins in a baby carriage, a little girl, I think it was a little girl, and then the young couple, a guy came out of the store and said, "Are you that homeless advocate guy?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm one of them." And he said, "You know, we don't want any more bums in our park." And he went on like this. And I said, they got to get a job. And I said, "Well, do you want to offer some jobs?" He says, "In Mexico, they'd have jobs. That wouldn't happen in Mexico." Apparently, he came from Mexico. And I said, offer a job before you start criticizing people for not working. And, you know, not that there's, you know, the greatest dignity in shit work that won't even get you a room, any kind of decent kind of medical care or, you know, a living wage. But if you're going to start, you know, playing holier-than-thou Puritan, make sure you know what you're talking about. Instead, there's this new kind of newly minted toxic bigotry that's sort of hanging over the city like a swampy fog. Last night, the Public Hysteria Citizens Task Force, as I call the Public Safety Citizen Task Force, met, and there was a report on it in today's paper, actually, which was kind of interesting because the people there were saying that they need to have free, there need to be free meals. The witnesses that they were calling in about drug addiction, what's the best way to deal with it? Expand needle exchange, otherwise you're going to get a far worse situation, far more illness, communicable illness, because of what the city council did by shutting down needle exchange in the city of Santa Cruz under the bigoted attacks by Take Back Santa Cruz and Clean Team types who came to Santa Cruz shaking their little cans of needles. So I had thought that, you know, absolutely nothing except bad propaganda could come out of this task force. But it was interesting to note that even police department watch poodle Shanna McCord, as I call her, a Sentinel writer who generally is a front for police puff pieces, a nice person, by the way. I have nothing against Shanna directly. She's a nice woman, but she's horrible as a reporter, as most of these Sentinel writers are. But this report actually mentioned the fact that, I mean, it did quote the, I think, police department, either Martinez or Hernandez, at length about how we can't arrest these people enough, and there's not enough places to jail them because, you know, they can ignore these tickets that we give them for such wonderful offenses as the police-created offenses of sitting next to a building and sleeping after 11 o'clock at night or covering up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night. I don't know. Going into a parking lot when it's raining, into a parking garage to get out of the rain, or being on the levee after dark, all these wonderful crimes that go to show that there's such a homeless crime wave that, of course, has been created by these very laws. But anyway, what this task force report from Shanna Banana McCord, as I call her, showed was that the experts they called in said, at least in terms of drug use and needle use, you need to have things like needle exchange. You need to have services where people can go, or things are just going to get worse. And if you look at the comments on the page for the Sentinel website where this was happening, you'll see a whole slew of invective against these experts or these witnesses that were called in. Because the agenda of this task force is to reaffirm the kind of bigoted Comstockery that Pamela Comstock and Lynn Robinson and Ken Collins and these people who have come out with their anti-homeless bigotry have been promulgating. That's another thing I did on Tuesday. I went to City Council and I played the Ken Collins video. That's the video that some of you may have seen, which shows people from the Clean Team, the group that goes around and cleans up the environment, finds needles, and brings them to City Council and denounces the council for not doing cleanups. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's good that they denounce the council. But then when they want to close down homeless services and demonize homeless people and mobilize people into hate crimes against homeless people, you would see Ken Collins, though his face is obscured and his voice is obscured, poking at a homeless person and swearing at him and denouncing him, as well as women from the Clean Team doing the same thing at a distance. I played that video the other day at the Santa Cruz City Council, and it was nothing new to them. They'd seen it before. They had absolutely nothing to say about it, except Pamela Comstock, co-founder of Take Back Santa Cruz, said, we're not associated with this group. We get permits for our cleanups, so Take Back Santa Cruz was not involved. Now, of course, she didn't mention that the Clean Team founder, T.J. Megalanes, who's been on this show, has testified, said that he had to leave town, or felt it became very uncomfortable in town for him because members of Take Back Santa Cruz took over the Clean Team website and essentially drove him off the website, because his reason for forming the Clean Team was not to get citizens out cleaning up campsites and harassing homeless people, but it was to get the city to do the kind of cleanups that needed to be done and to provide facilities for homeless people, like needle disposal sites, like campgrounds, like bathrooms. That was the one big victory that supposedly Micah Posner there were two things he mentioned at the last city council meeting, or he mentioned that happened after the last city council meeting. One is that the city is now apparently scoping out not a bathroom, but a porta potty, to be placed, a 24-hour porta potty, to be placed near the Community Credit Union in the parking lot, the city parking lot there. And that's nice. But his he immediately followed this up by saying to me, can you make sure that people don't vandalize it and pass the word, because we're not going to get a bathroom if they vandalize. This is the same kind of bad apple in the barrel nonsense that I was talking about earlier. This city needs 24-hour bathrooms, however vandalized they get. It's one of those basic necessities of a civilized community. It simply is. So if Posner is going to sit around and engage in these timid half steps and then sort of be able to back away because he won't stand up on these issues and say, we want a 24-hour bathroom regardless of how many times it gets vandalized. I imagine bathrooms in bars get vandalized all the time by drunks. They get replaced. It's just the cost of doing business, and it's the cost of doing business in a civilized community here. The other thing that happened that Posner got into was the main reason that I went to, well, not the main reason, but one of the reasons I went to the 5 o'clock oral communication session at City Council on Tuesday, day before yesterday. And that was because the bike church was finally, we hoped, coming out of its little lair. The rabbits were coming out and saying, oh, please, Mr. Council members, can you give us back the bikes that we're not able to give to the kids, because you know, we want them back, and we're really good people, and that sort of, instead of saying, the fucking police department has stonewalled on these bikes for a year and a half for no good reason other than its political hostility to the bike church. This is outrageous. They've been passing them on to the bike dojo, And the guy, the two individuals who are apparently at least partial owners or managers of the bike dojo, I think one guy's name is Rob Miles, another one is he was talking about coming on the air. He seemed much more temperate. Rob is a really vituperative, foul-mouthed guy. I mean, I can get pretty colorful in my language, for sure. But this guy, every second sentence is an insult. And he's a pretty peppery character. I did do a couple of interviews with him. Unfortunately, the tape recorder did not function well. And I do have some video of this interview 2 days ago, actually. Well, this exchange, where he kept on saying, "Why are people attacking me for my business?" And the answer is because he serves as a sort of a front group so the police department can deny bikes to the bike church, which had always been receiving them and distributing them to nonprofits. And then as a political decision, they possibly with the connivance of Mayor Bryant, they were removed. And that is that was a controversy that it didn't even come up except very briefly in the comments of a few people who weren't even really that directly connected with the bike church. The bike church people themselves were tiptoeing the Mr. Nice Guy, Ms. Nice Woman line. You know, we won't offend anybody. We just want there to be a process for us to get our bikes. Instead of holding the police, city managers Martine Bernal and assistant city manager Tina Schul, responsible for this long time double talk, bullshit, and delay, and the decision to stop the bikes going to the bike church, to send them instead to a group that has financial connections with Mayor Bryant's spouse's business. That's not denied. And essentially to engage in a kind of political favoritism that sounds like it's probably illegal. I don't know if it is or not for sure, but that has been a concern that Steve Schnarr and others have raised. But again, not at this meeting. They were too genteel to raise it in any really strong way. And Micah Posner said, "Well, we've opened up bids to resume, to find a person to give the bikes to," instead of saying, "I want to see those bikes go back to the bike church where they were, unless there are specific problems that the bike church cannot address." And the police department apparently failed to articulate those problems except months later after they had moved it to the bike dojo. And I've talked about this on the air before. A little more from the Red Church from last Monday, and then Uncle Dennis should be in the studio with From the Cream to the Dregs. I'll be back on Sunday in the morning with another streamy show, and hopefully it'll be more homeless content and less about foreign affairs.
A retina scan.
No DNA, nothing like that today. No.
What's the story about storage out there? I take it they have no storage lockers?
No storage lockers, nothing like that.
What do they do with your bike if you come in with a bike?
They put it in the bike rack area and lock it up there.
How about if you have a backpack when you walk in?
You got to leave it outside.
And is it usually there when you get there, when you come out?
The dining hall, yeah. Sometimes. That's if they got some tweaker taking your shit.
Now, is there a lot of, discomfort for people who are trying to abstain from the use of intoxicating medications, fluids, and methy poo? In other words, is it a difficult situation for them? Is there a lot of dealing, using, problems of that sort, in a way that would impact other people?
Yeah, still.
And how are other people impacted by that?
Just the dealers being there, pushing it onto them. Everybody just taking it out. Why not? Better to do down there.
And has that changed much in the last few years? Better, worse, the same?
It's about the same.
Okay. And are people making complaints about it, or is it sort of simply accepted as a part of the usual hoop-de-doo?
Everybody just accepts it for what it is. Nothing's going to change. on that scene down there.
Are they coming to get you?
Oh, yeah, always. They're going to put me in the white jacket, make me love myself and hug myself.
Actually, that's a fire truck. So we've been talking with a local doctor. What's your name again?
Doc Holliday.
Thank you, Doc Holliday. Heard that before. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
All right.
About 35 or 40 people inside listening to Father Joel Miller. And you have a report from the street?
Well, you see, me, I was, I used to hang out across from the town clock, Liberty Bell, and hang out over there by what they say closed area for vegetation restoration after they raped all the flowers and shit. So now and then I've been, like, sleeping across, sometimes across from the other Liberty Bell by the bank. That has a fence, but where they don't have first alarm, I guess.
Which bank?
The one that used to be Bank of the West, the closed one with the you know, across from the north of the Bell.
Town Clock.
Liberty Bell. Yeah, whatever.
Liberty Bell. I hadn't been aware there's a Liberty Bell at the Town Clock. But
I call it the Town Clock. Some call it the Clock Tower. I call it Liberty Bell. You know, don't. You know, the bells.
We're talking, by the way, with
Taliban Tony.
Of course.
Terrorist.
What's your report, Tony? Go ahead.
I'm not even a Taliban, but they can...
No.
They call me a terrorist. I've been arrested with terrorist threats, brandishing a weapon, drinking when I was in the... But anyway, so there I am sleeping with my buddy. Across where the bank has no first alarm, where the landlord doesn't care if we stay there, because I guess the mayor's a little peed, because there's no first alarm there, but... There's a fence through the liability insurance. I know all about that kind of shit.
How many people are sleeping there?
It was Mike and me, and the pig showed up. The pig dogs.
You're talking about our police officers.
PD, no, I thought about pig dogs. Police officers, they don't bring you, they don't take your donut. They bring you a donut. I don't accept it.
Men in blue uniforms?
Yeah, the ones who stole my donut.
Badges and guns?
They blame it on the ducks.
With the batons and tasers?
I think the ducks did steal this donut because they
Let's get back to the story here, Tony.
Crumbs all over the park. They're looking for the donuts. Yum, yum, donuts, whatever that is.
Get back to the arrival of these...
Well, anyway, they threatened to arrest me for trespassing the next time I show up there. So now I'm not allowed there.
So they've removed your sleeping spot.
I thought I was loitering.
Uh-huh.
What happened to... I got strike two on this Prop 36 for... used to be camping, but it wasn't. It was lodging, but that's a state law. They don't do lodging no more?
The lodging requires a jury trial. Of course, so does trespass. They're probably just threatening
it's a state
you.
Law. Lodging
is
state
it
law.
It is a state law, both of them.
Camping is a city...
Camping is a trespass.
Because there is a legal...
Trespass is
I read up on a long time ago.
Trespass is a state law.
State and federal law, you can sleep in any public place, anytime, anywhere.
Not really, no. That's, I don't know where you got that idea.
Since it was on Peace Black and White?
Show it to me. I'd like to see it. I'll show it to the world if you can find it.
Well, I have to show it to you when I get around to showing it.
All right, I want to see it.
If I had a phone, I'd know how to use it, but I don't trust my bell.
Well, I don't trust you.
My
either.
Bell...
But that's another story.
My bell is not...
So you were told by the police to move on?
No, threatened.
Threatened? What do you mean? What did they threaten to do?
Arrest me.
I mean, give you a place to sleep for the night? So to speak.
Pink socks with pink pants and no Pink Floyd.
Nah, that's not what you wanted.
I don't know. They want to hook me up with a pill.
Want to move out? Let me know. I'll move my pill.
They want to hook me up with a pill, but no cigarettes.
So, what time did this incident occur?
Midnight.
And were you also? Was your colleague also told to move on?
Yes, he was threatened.
I see.
We got to take it.
How many police officers were involved in this exchange?
There was a pig bitch and a pig dog. Arrogant pig dog went back.
Do you know the names of these individuals?
Kind of not really, but they know my name.
I see.
I'm trying to forget their name.
Well, I want to thank you for your update, Tony. And
so, what do we do about this situation?
Sin and Barrett.
Gene, I'm not allowed to have a knife or a gun until the 13th, but I'm allowed to have a lighter to light a fuse. Can you get a cannonball in a cannon?
I will leave that to you. Thank you, Tony. So we're talking with a.
That's it for Bathroom Spears Broadsides coming up. And coming up next is the loud clapping of this guy, whatever his name is. What's your name again?
Uncle Dennis.
Uncle Dennis, that's it. Yeah, I know. I have the tip of my tongue.
Well, you know.
All these Dennises.
With your memory loss lately.
You know, it's
2 weeks and you can't even.
We're not on the radio anymore, so what do I need to remember anything for? I mean, we're fading out, Dennis. We're fading. We're a thing of the past, man. It's history. We're history. We're going down, down that long, fading road. Well,
we'll be back.
I hope so.
On the air.
You're taking a vacation, though, right?
I'm taking some time off here and there.
Does that mean you will still be available if some soul comes forward to provide a space for a transmitter?
Yes.
I see. So you may dash back into town to help out.
I'll be back when I'm back.
You'll be back. Listen, that's pretty vague, folks, I got to tell you. So you better...
The collective got an email.
There may be a transmitter site coming up, perhaps?
Well, we're looking at them.
We're looking for sites. So get those site information.
Good site.
We need a good site. And so Dennis will tell you more about it. He's more silver-tongued than I at this point. So I'm going to leave you with some kind of questionable music while Dennis sets up, and I can be reached at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, if you have any concerns, complaints, commendations, large cash donations, you name it.
If you need a stalker...
That's Dennis's... see you on Sunday, or rather, talk to you on Sunday.
Once they gave welfare to the poor, food stamps for the grocery store. But now there's work there, you know there's been a switch. The poor sweep up the streets, and welfare's for the rich. It's a workfare life if you're not rich.